This is an eavesdropping conversation. I'm Juliet Fraser, and today my guest is Susan Lolivar. Welcome, Susan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for speaking with me. It's really nice to see you. So I've developed this habit of not really introducing my guests, but rather asking them to introduce themselves so we get an introduction in their words, I suppose. So tell us, how do you describe yourself as a musician?
So I would describe myself as primarily a composer, although some kind of elements of performing are becoming more and more part of what I do. My background is I'm British and Iranian, and my music kind of reflects that. So my training, you know, from the age of whatever, five, is really in Western music, but Western classical music. But for the over the last 10 years, I've been working a lot in Iranian music. And I guess what I'm really interested in is kind of producing a musical practice that in some ways reflected the things that I had experienced in my life, which is that these two things were always entangled in a way that they were almost kind of indivisible, and in a way that, as with anyone who has this experience, is kind of completely unique to me and my experience. This isn't about, or at least my aim is not to kind of take two sort of frozen musical traditions and just kind of collide them together. It's about a much deeper relationship of living with these musical cultures for my whole life and finding ways to kind of bring them together that feels kind of natural for me. So some of the ways that transpires is I write a lot of my music on the santur, which is an Iranian hammered dulcimer, which also you can tune to anything, which is really handy because my music is generally uses different kind of tuning systems. And draws on and is inspired by these two musical traditions that have been a huge part of my life for a very long time.
In retrospect, do you think there was a way that the two traditions could have been running in parallel from a younger age, that shift that you describe happening, I think you said about 10 years ago, that could have been avoided by having the two running side by side?
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely engaging with Iranian music and Iranian culture from a very, very young age. But it probably wasn't, well, it was different forms of culture, I guess. Like, I was born in the UK, but my sister and I went to a kind of amazing community youth group when I was three. And we kind of have always remained connected to it. So we would go to loads of parties, we'd go to sort of Iranian festivals and festivities, and there was always music and there was always dancing. It was mostly like quite kind of 90s Iranian pop bangers, which remain a source of great inspiration to me. I mean, they are pretty amazing. Probably the engagement with classical music was a lot less and came a bit later.
You mean Iranian classical music?
Yeah, Iranian classical music. But it was there. It was there in the background and, you know, in kind of films and things like that. But probably I wasn't so consciously engaging with it. And then when you go to Iran, there's a lot of music in parties, you know, these things happen. So they were running alongside each other. But yeah, I guess it was about 10 years ago when I started to do it very consciously. And I think that was really, that came out of almost like a sense of loss, because there was a period when I was a child, we used to go to Iran every year, you know, my whole family would go. And then when I turned about maybe 16, we stopped going as a family, and it was kind of slightly left up to me and my sister, like, well, if you want to go, you can go, your whole family's there, you kind of sort it out. And I didn't go for 10 years because I think my relationship to Iran was a bit complicated, you know, also 16 to 26, complicated time. And you're kind of finding out, working things out and stuff. So I didn't go for 10 years. And then I think when I decided to start engaging with the music, it was a way of actually rebuilding my relationship with Iran. So yeah, it's sort of come in and out of my life at important points.
And professionally, do you manage to straddle the two countries? I know you've done a lot of work in America, actually, but how, your base is here in the UK, but how is that evolving professionally?
Yeah, so I lived in the US for a year. Actually, when I moved to the US was specifically to study Iranian music. There's an amazing, amazing guy called Reza Voli, who's in Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And he's this sort of brilliant expert in both Western and Iranian music. So yeah, I mean, that was an interesting time traveling to and from the US. But yeah, I've done a few things in Iran. I had a few performances in Iran. I've worked with a few Iranian ensembles. It's very challenging working there. I mean, I'd say classical music is generally, in terms of the kinds of music that are controversial in Iran, classical music is among the least controversial. Popular music, those are much more complicated, and that's obviously not what I operate in. I haven't had anything there for a little while, but I'm hoping to kind of get that going again soon.
And this question of being split across two different cultures is something that you have written about in your new book, which I think is yet to be published, but just about to be published. Is that right? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, it should be coming out shortly, probably in March, I think. Mm. I'm not entirely certain. So this book comes partly out of my PhD, which was looking at using composition as a kind of way of thinking through particularly the experience of diaspora. Thinking about it through this quite personal lens, because there's a lot of academic writing about diaspora that's amazing, and that comes from a kind of sociological viewpoint, or maybe a kind of a viewpoint of human geography, or obviously musicology. There's loads of writing on diaspora in kind of music studies. But I was really interested in what we could add to that conversation by taking a really, really personal viewpoint. So it's using this method called autoethnography, which is kind of a become quite fashionable over the last few years, but it's really a way of using your life as a way of thinking about things more critically. And that's something that actually groups in society who are generally non-normative, you know, the non-majority groups, the groups who might find themselves feeling, you know, experiencing discrimination and oppression, those groups have done this for a very, very long time. Talking about, writing about experiences in your life, some, you know, things like emotion and pain as a way of theorizing otherness. So like bell hooks does that like really amazingly. Audre Lorde does it a lot. There's loads and loads of examples. And so I was interested in taking this like very, very personal viewpoint of my own experience of diaspora, which is something I really, really struggled with for a very long time. I always felt just a bit lost, to be honest, and a bit, you know, not really enough of anything in any place, like too British in Iran and too Iranian in the UK. And yeah, I was really interested in using composition, because composition is that way of moving and making and thinking with a body. And, you know, we are embodied beings, and often we express emotion and pain particularly through our body. So what would it look like to think through this experience with music? And see where we come out. So that's kind of what the book is about, really. And it's accompanied by two pieces of mine. And I really encourage people to listen to the pieces when they read them. You know, I give timestamps. It's supposed to be quite an embodied experience. I don't want them to just read in a sort of detached way. It's reading and listening are completely intertwined in the way the book is presented.
And the book, for anybody who wants to explore it, is called... It's quite a long title, isn't it?
It's a very academic title.
Are we ready?
I get a choice on the title, to be clear.
It's called Embodied Research Through Music Composition and Evocative Life Writing. And I think you've got a new album coming out as well.
Yes, I've got an album coming out 15th of March. It comes out. And actually two of the pieces that are explored in the book are on the album, which is quite a nice kind of synergy. And it's working with an ensemble called Ruthless Jabberoo and a conductor called Kelly Lovelady. It's four pieces of mine written over a 6-7 year period. And it's nice. I think they chart a bit of a development of my sort of voice, my musical voice in that time. You know, my relationship to sort of tuning systems, my relationship to Iranian music, my relationship to like different kind of musical forms. So I think you can kind of see this progression, which I think is kind of interesting. And it's nice to have your kind of music presented together in one place. I feel like it's so easy to be doing this, something here and something there and all over the place. So it's quite a treat to be like, this is a singular thing. And
I'd like to know more about your work as a composer. I'm wondering how the compositional process tends to unfold for you.
It's a really, really interesting question. And I think it's always changing. And I think I'm in a particular groove at the moment, which feels quite different, but I'm really enjoying. So the thing that's happening to me a lot at the moment is I find that I'm writing several pieces that actually feel like one piece, really. But I'm just coming back to those same ideas. I think I'm going much more in a direction at the moment of writing a piece being an exercise in world building. So what so the majority of my time is spent often just sitting in silence or doing very, very little, but just making the world.
In your head.
Yeah, in my head.
Somehow.
Yeah, and using the Santor and, you know, using bits and pieces, but just constructing what that world is. And then once that world exists, you just go for a walk around it, basically. So the actual final bit of making the piece can often be really fast. It'll just be setting up a process, maybe, and then just letting that process unfold. But because the world is there, like, I know how to walk around in it very easily. I mean, it's partly through kind of practical, I think I'm trying to be a bit more economic with my time. So, and often, like, I'll write a piece and then I'll go away and I'll be like, say it's like a 15-minute piece. I'll be like, that 2 minutes was really good. The rest of it was okay. And then I'll just take out that 2 minutes and repeat it and use that as the basis for a new piece. So I'm like reusing a lot of material now. Yeah, just kind of thinking of myself as writing one piece for the last couple of years and just popping up at different points in it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's proving kind of fruitful for me at the moment.
And did that happen sort of by accident? Did it take you by surprise when you stumbled into this process? Or was it something that was a bit more designed, do you think?
Well, so it's really interesting. And I know you're obviously super interested in failure and the whole idea around failure. And in a way,
I am.
Yeah, we love failure. In a way, this kind of came out of what felt like a kind of failure for me musically and as a composer. Yeah, so in 2021, I became very ill. I was diagnosed with cancer and I had to take basically 18 months completely off work. And I just, life suddenly went from being very, very busy, very kind of stressful, but very exciting, to being unbelievably crap and boring. Like, anyone who's been ill knows that it's just so dull, and you just kind of in the hospital a lot, and it's just very bleh. But basically, one of the kind of outcomes of that was sort of making a series of decisions about the way I wanted my life to be in the medium term. Very, you know, this big possibility that I could get ill again, and having really struggled financially in that period, because obviously, you know, we don't have a lot of sick pay, we don't have a lot of support. Like, I mean, I was fine, I was very supported by my family, but it wasn't like an ideal situation. So I decided to take a job completely outside of music. And initially that decision was I was leaving music. And I actually sent some like slightly dramatic emails, like, I'm leaving, I'm turning this commission down because I'm leaving music forever. And they were like, okay. Which in hindsight was a bit excessive. But so the plan was leave music, get a job in an office, live a really simple life, relax. But I completely failed to leave music. It didn't happen. I think it happened for maybe like a week. And then I was like saying yes to things again. Like, but anyway, but basically the outcome of this is that I now have less time. So this kind of musical decision was very practical. It was as a result of, yeah, kind of life happening and you having a lot less time and just having to make decisions. And I don't know, it's made me think a lot about lots of other artists. Well, the artists who we know who did this, but also the artists who will never know, because maybe I think this might be a thing that is that a lot of women artists in history have experienced. You know, maybe you have a child, maybe you have caring responsibilities, which we know often fall on women particularly. You know, how many of them, their artist career was just derailed by that?
Yeah.
And therefore we don't know who they are.
Yeah.
Or even ones who we know, like I know like Morton Feldman, who's a musician that I love very much. I know he was like a patent clerk, wasn't he, for like a long time. And you know, how much of what I love about his music, the economy, the way he uses gesture so sparingly, how much of that comes out of the fact that maybe he had a job and he was kind of busy and he was like, I need to make some decisions really fast. I have no idea, but it's something I think about and I am kind of holding on to as like this thing that felt like a total failure. Like I have failed in my dream to be a composer because of all of these reasons, partly my health failing me. I'm trying to kind of reconstitute it as, well, maybe this is now my aesthetic and maybe there's something interesting about that.
And has there been an adjustment that you've had to make to come to terms with the fact that you are leading these two parallel careers now? Has that required some sort of reframing? Was there an element of failure, perhaps, even in not doing music full time, you know, that kind of vocational, rather loaded idea of a composer in the garret, blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. And the one thing that I've really noticed about it, and again, like, you know, like with anything, as soon as you notice that this thing, it becomes a little bit easier, is the code switching required.
Yeah.
Which luckily is something that I have a lot of experience of. You know, code switching between Iranian space and British space is something I did as a child all the time. Yeah, I do have to code switch from my kind of, you know, office job life to my music life. And there'll be times when they really collide.
Mm-hmm.
So I took 10 days off work in November 23 to go to South Africa for the ISCM kind of World Music Days Festival. And I was the British delegate. But I spent 10 days really intensely in this festival. You know, I was kind of representing, you know, I was like the UK and meeting all these composers, and just, and also I had to put together, my piece was a kind of improvised piece, which I had to put together with these musicians very last minute. And it was they were absolutely fantastic. It was completely wonderful, but it was quite, you know, it was like we had 3 hours rehearsal before the electricity went off. So it was like, you know, get your shit together, basically.
Wow.
And then I came back and suddenly, and I like literally like I landed at 6 a.m. and I went straight into work. But it was a bit wild. It was like, oh, like literally 24 hours ago, I was conducting a group who were playing my piece. And now I'm like moving things around on a spreadsheet. And it was a bit nuts.
Yeah. And sticking on the topic of work, I'm wondering what your observations are with your particular perspective about our music industry and what the strengths and perhaps failings of that are.
Yeah, and it's been really interesting because I, you know, I only ever worked in music beforehand. Like I didn't really have any job outside of it. It has made me recognize some of the really wonderful things about our industry and some of the completely toxic things about our industry. To start with the toxic, we just have no work-life balance. Or at least I didn't. Some people might be better at it than me.
I definitely don't. Hopeless.
I just literally worked all the time. And it's easy to do it because you love it, but you don't love it enough to never, ever, ever rest. I think that was one of my problems is, and it's a problem I have generally, I think, is that because, well, like all musicians, I was always working on so many different things. There was five, six projects going at the same time. Whenever you had a gap in something, you were like, oh, this is my time to write that blurb.
Do the other thing,
Yeah, it's like you never, ever prioritized rest. Like, and rest means, well, it can mean many different things to different people, but it means, sometimes it means doing nothing. And the moment that I realized I have no idea how to rest was when I was forced to rest for 18 months and I was so bad at it. But yeah, I mean, that's obviously also partly me, but I think music, the music industry teaches us all that rest is bad or that, you know, you could always be improving this or, you know, optimizing that or doing that application, and just sheer looking after yourself kind of comes quite low down, I think, which is something I think we should all think about. Also, this is maybe a good and a bad, I'm not sure. Like one thing, when you work, now I work in like a company where, you know, this is this person's job and this is this person's job and this is how you connect and you do your bit and then you pass on to them. It's all very regimented, all very clear. You know, probably less exciting, but it's very calming. Whereas I feel like in music, and this is kind of maybe a great strength as well, everything is your job. You know, okay, maybe if I wrote a piece for you, I probably wouldn't sing it. Like there would be a line there. But, you know, you write the piece, you promote the piece, you do the marketing, you write the blurb, you get the money for the performance, you find the performer, you do everything. That is extremely exhausting, but I do ultimately think that is an amazing experience to have. So we're all amazing in that sense. We've all got incredible skills and incredible energy.
But I'm not sure about that. I think that it's those of us that do have quite a cluster of skills that can excel in that way. And actually there are many people who find it very difficult to write words, for example. And so doing their own marketing copy or doing a funding application is really challenging, or people who are very introverted and find it difficult to sell a project or to approach people that they don't know about a project. And I think the expectation that we can do everything is a bit problematic, really, because it's sort of setting up this superhero model, which isn't very healthy.
That's really true. That's a really good point. And then we come back to this thing of failure again. Like I think as a music, when I was only a musician, I felt on the edge of failure every day.
Yeah.
You know, and really, really quite stressed out a lot of the time, constantly worried about just messing things up and things not being good enough and things being a disaster and all those things. In work, that doesn't really happen. That's not really possible to fail in work. Mm. You can definitely do things less well. You can definitely have, you know, a better and worse project. But short of being like literally the CEO or something, it's quite hard to fail in like a kind of corporate environment, because just that's just not how they think about things.
Mm.
It's not on one person. Everything is done by so many people that there's only degrees of success, really.
Mm.
Quite life-changing.
Yeah, well, what a host of great ideas, and I'm so pleased that you're going to be speaking to us more about some of these. So Susan is giving a talk on failure on Saturday the 23rd of March in session one, the morning session of the forum, as part of the Eavesdropping Festival at Cafe Otto. Well, Susan, thank you so much for chatting with me, and I'm a little bit disappointed that it hasn't been a complete failure.
Oh, don't worry. There's still time to talk. We'll see how that goes.
No, I think it's going to be great. And I think it's probably going to be quite fun as well on the basis of today's chat.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great. A big cathartic failure expression session, hopefully.
Yes. Yes, that's what we want. Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to an Eavesdropping Conversation. Our new jingle was composed for us by Iza Otoya.